Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of a conversation at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's conversation focuses on the ways in which technology and the best practices from Silicon Valley can help end extreme poverty. In this hour, we're going to hear from Anne Mae Cheng. She's the Chief Innovation Officer and Executive Director of the U.S. Government's Global Development Lab. She's in conversation with Jacqueline Fuller, President of Google.org. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Scott Wu. He's the partner and head of investments at Omidyar Network.
Thank you all for joining us tonight. I'm Scott Wu, and it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guests. Their resumes are quite impressive, and for the benefit of those on the radio, I'm actually going to read through each of your resumes. Anne Mae Cheng is the Chief Innovation Officer and the Executive Director of U.S. Global Development Lab at USAID. Previously, she was Chief Innovation Officer at Mercy Corps and also Senior Advisor for Women and Technology at the Department of State. Anne Mae has more than 20 years of engineering and leadership experience in Silicon Valley with companies including Apple, Intuit, and SGI. She was a Senior Engineering Director at Google and also led their product development for emerging markets with a mission to bring mobile and internet services to the two-thirds of the world's population not yet online. Jacqueline Fuller leads Google.org, Google's philanthropic arm, which provides more than $100 million yearly to support innovators using technology for humanity. Jacqueline previously served as Deputy Director of Global Health at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and previously Jacqueline and her family moved to Delhi, India, where she helped launch a $300 million health initiative for the Gates Foundation. She also serves on the board of GiveDirectly. Very impressive. And so, thank you again. Let's get started. So we have a former government employee, now with a tech titan, and a former Google engineer, now with a U.S. government agency, here to share with us tonight lessons about ending global poverty. So from my lens at Omidyar Network, we're seeing an influx of interest from technologists, from entrepreneurs, from capital sources around the world into the frontier markets to address issues of health and education, energy, and climate change. And so my first question is for you, Anne Mae. What major advances do you see occurring with technology and innovation in the international development world?
Thanks, Scott. I think this is a really unique time when it comes to technology and innovation for development. We're seeing the convergence of two trends. So one is we've all experienced here in the United States the incredible advances in digital technology and how that's affected our lives. And we're starting to see that be more true in developing countries, giving people who don't even have access to clean water or toilet access to a mobile phone. At the same time, there's an incredible need. The world adopted a set of audacious goals called the Sustainable Development Goals last year with the top line goal of ending extreme poverty. This is a really important moral imperative. And at the same time, estimates are that we're probably $1 to $3 trillion a year short of meeting that goal on our current trajectory. And I think that one of the important pieces of bridging that gap is innovation and technology. With innovation and technology, we can find solutions that get us better bang for buck and accelerate our progress towards reaching the goal of ending extreme poverty.
Is it a money issue? $1 to $3 trillion a year to solve these big problems? That doesn't sound that severe.
$1 to $3 trillion is a lot of money.
It is.
And I think, with the challenges of the global economy,
yes.
I don't think it's going to be realistic for governments to cough up that amount of money.
Okay.
And so what I think we really need to do is look at how we can spend the money that we're spending more effectively, because I think with technology, with innovation, we can have solutions that are 2 times or 10 times as effective as they are today, as well as look at ways that we can tap into new sources of funding with both the private sector and local governments contributing more and more to solving problems in developing countries.
Great. And Jacqueline, what advances are you witnessing?
Well, we work primarily through partners around the world, and some of the exciting things that we've seen, for example, is, you know, in development, we're all trying to get towards measurement of around real outcomes, right? So instead of just saying, hey, we've drilled another well, we want to know how many people are actually getting clean water and how many people are actually getting that clean water 5 years after that well has been drilled. In fact, in the developing world, as you guys know, about a third of the wells don't even work at any given time. So take sensor technology, for example. We're working with Charity Water to develop a water flow sensor that's going to go on every single one of their 30,000 water points around the world and relay in real time whether or not the water is actually flowing. So that can help create a whole system of accountability and a whole different set of incentives around what gets produced. So I think sensors are really exciting. We're doing things like partnering with World Wildlife Fund to use drones for conservation in places like Namibia, where you have huge areas, vast expanses where we need to protect rhinos and elephants. And not in 5 years, we need to do it now before the spiral of extinction. So I think taking some of our current technologies that are being adapted to say maybe deliver that dress that you need right on time, you know, can also help with rhinos in Africa.
And why is it so hard to keep wells working, and or to even know that they're not working?
Well, I mean, even with the sensor, for example, when we first, so as Google, you know, we're familiar with technology risk and comfortable with it. Our mantra is, you know, go ahead and fail, but fail fast, lean into it, learn quickly. But even with that sensor project, you know, it sounds so simple and like something off the shelf would work. And when our engineers first took a look at it with Charity Water, it looked like there was a solution that was going to be pretty darn easy to implement. But, you know, you put it out in the field in Eritrea for, you know, 6-7 months, and with windstorms and dirt storms and the temperatures and whatnot, you discover that the technology actually needs a few more generations for it to actually work. So we got there, but it took some time. So I think part of it is developing for conditions that are different from where sometimes the majority of the technologists are working.
And so you made a reference to a website for dresses. And so how do we better guide Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and technologists to start focusing on the solutions, the big problems in the world, rather than on writing the next disappearing photo or or whoopee cushion app?
Food delivery app. Yeah. You know, here's the thing. As human beings, we all work on and get excited about the problems that are proximate to us, right? So we invest in people and we try and solve issues that we know firsthand. And so part of the problem is making us, those of us who are in Silicon Valley, more proximate to the conditions happening around the world, more aware. I think the second thing is also ensuring that we're funding the best innovators around the world, whether they happen to sit in Silicon Valley or Nairobi. And so we make sure as Google.org that we are going out and finding and funding the best innovators regardless of where they are. One quick thing I will say, though, one interesting thing, and Anne May probably knows this very well as a female technologist herself, if you look at the issue of computer science and wanting to produce a more diverse and inclusive environment around computer science, the research that we did as Google looked at what motivates young women to go into computer science and stay in computer science. And it's the ability to use computational thinking to change the world, make the world better. And in particular, when places like the UC Berkeley, for example, changed their introductory class so that the problem sets that those engineers were working on were things like, how do you reduce infant mortality in Kenya? They had a much higher retention rate for women. So an interesting little
side benefit. So it shouldn't be difficult to entice women, at least, to focus on the big problems.
We've got to work on the dudes.
Well, I also think that this is a trend among millennials, too, that I think this new generation that's growing up is really passionate about making a difference in the world and making a world a better place. And I think that I totally agree with Jacqueline. People need to understand the problems that are out there. One of the ways that, one of the things that we believe strongly in and is this concept of open innovation and looking at how we can tap into the ingenuity of people around the world. And we do that through a number of our different open innovation challenges and prizes. So USAID runs 7 or 8 grand challenges that focus attention on a number of different areas where we think better solutions are needed, as well as we issue prizes, such as our Desal Prize last year, looking for better technology for desalinating water, which is a big challenge in many parts of the world. And so by creating these challenges and prizes, we shine a light on where the greatest needs are, and then we go out and really recruit people from universities, from the private sector, entrepreneurs, people in developing countries who may have solutions that we never thought of before. And many times they come up with ideas that are incredibly ingenious.
And where was the light shining when you made that switch from a cushy tech titan into the world of saving the world?
So for me, I have had this long-standing crazy idea that I wanted to spend the first half of my career in Silicon Valley in the private sector, and really spend the second half of my career looking at how I could do something more meaningful to make the world a better place. And so,
but you're not quite yet at the second half of your career.
I am actually. About 5 years ago, I decided to make that switch. And so I actually took a leave of absence from Google and went to the State Department through a fellowship program called the Franklin Fellowship. It was a great experience. It just opened my eyes to a whole different world. Because here in Silicon Valley, we live a little bit in a bubble here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we barely know that there's like a federal government in D.C. And so I hadn't actually met anyone from the federal government about a few months before I went to work there. And I was lucky to meet some people on this tech delegation that I joined while I was working at Google. And we went to Liberia and Sierra Leone. And it really opened my eyes to a different part of the world and a ways in which technology could really make a dramatic difference in developing countries as well.
So it seems like for each of you, it was part of a longer, broader plan. And maybe not. But for others in the Valley, is it simply identifying the problem and they will come?
Well, I think, it's interesting, Scott, that in our introductions, all three of us have cycled through government, Silicon Valley, working for for-profits, not-for-profits. I think that kind of flow and different experiences is really, really helpful. I think what an engineer like Anne May can bring by going to USAID is just an incredible vision for what technology can and can't accomplish. But we are also blessed in Silicon Valley when we get folks who have government experience, because government workers are used to solving problems at scale. Mm-hmm. So I know even on my team, I've been really fortunate to have someone from USAID come, for example, and work with us for a little while on impact evaluation. Mm-hmm. So I think both sides have things to learn from each other.
Well, we're all hoping that Google learns about scale one of these days.
Yeah.
And I would say that the world's problems are getting more and more complex, and they're problems that we can't solve alone, with government alone or the private sector alone. And so I believe that these problems are going to be solved by working across sectors where we can bring together government and private sector and NGOs to bring the best of what we each have to offer, because we have different talents, we have different resources to bear. And so I think we need more people who really understand all sides of that equation, because we do all live in silos. There's very little understanding, as I've been in different sectors, of understanding how the other parts of the world work. Mm-hmm. And so having more of us who can translate across that, I think, is incredibly valuable. I think more people like you, Scott, who took a break in your career to come out and work for government.
The world doesn't need any more people like me. Thank you. So once people are enticed and they're inclined to make the switch, the younger talent, the international development sector is often considered to be highly bureaucratic. It's wasteful, it's risk averse, it's ineffective, and those are probably some of the nicer characterizations. And so what can Google and the lab do to help change that culture and to lead the industry into being more nimble and adaptive and thereby producing better outcomes?
Well, I think there's two sides to that. So one is, it's absolutely true, large institutions are bureaucratic. Even a large institution like Google can become very bureaucratic. But what we're seeing with a lot of young people is a new creation of a new movement for social enterprise. So you don't have to go into a large institution. You can be an entrepreneur. Yeah. You can come up with your innovation and build a business around it and be very agile and nimble and stay small. And so we're seeing many solutions coming out of these social entrepreneurs that sort of have a double bottom line of doing well while doing good.
And will they scale?
Some of them do, not all of them, but it's just like any startup. Some of them are successful and some of them are less successful. So I think social enterprises are a growing part of the solution. I also think that for those of people who have the patience, government and large institutions are incredibly important. As Jacqueline and I were talking about earlier, it's like in government, you can really change the system. And I think that's what the lab is trying to do within government, is really exemplify a different model of how we can be more nimble, more data-driven, more open in the way that we do development, and demonstrate the effectiveness of those kinds of approaches, and then indoctrinate the rest of government towards that.
train.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. And I think, you know, a strategy that we've pursued is to try and really invest in some of the best minds, best teams, regardless where they are, where they're using innovation and technology to take on, you know, huge development problems. So, for example, we'll work with someone like Fast Forward, which is a local tech incubator who's specifically funding groups who are working on these kinds of issues. We don't have enough of that kind of, not only funding, but that kind of acceleration coming around the best and brightest who are investing their time and talent towards solving world challenges versus making the next home delivery, food delivery app, right? So I think that's one piece of it. But we can't forget the big boys. You know, I used to be on the board of a sort of multi-billion dollar NGO, and it was interesting that the innovation funds that they had available, so an NGO with a throughput more than $1 billion, had an innovation fund of $100,000. And that was funded by a few engineers, actually, from Silicon Valley who thought it was important. But, you know, so I think what's important, and why I mentioned, for example, a partnership with WWF or with Charity Water, we also want to work with some of the larger scaling groups, Mercy Corps, for example, who has a whole innovation program. We want to work within some of the larger groups because that's also how you're going to get scale. And then the other thing I'll say is we've partnered as Google.org, we've partnered with USAID on things as well because we recognize we can, our catalytic funding can take things to a certain point, but then we really need government as the engines of scalable change.
Well, Amy, you were the chief innovation officer at Mercy Corps. Is it easy to shift the practices of a larger NGO such as that?
I think that, you know, no, it's not easy to shift.
Is it doable?
But it is doable. And I think whether at Mercy Corps, at USAID, you know, changing the system is a long, slow, but very rewarding process. I think there's really three things that need to happen. So the first is that we actually need data. To Jacqueline's point, I completely agree with sensor data, with other kinds of data. Traditionally, with development programs, we tend to do a midline evaluation, sort of if you have a five-year program, 2.5 years in, it usually takes a year. So about 3.5 years in, you finally start figuring out whether your program's working. And then you do an endline evaluation at the end of 5 years. And it's just too slow to make rapid progress. So trying to figure out ways, especially now with mobile data sources, with sensors, with satellites, we have a lot of new opportunity to get data much more quickly. So you need information first to move quickly. The second is that you need systems. You need the processes and systems that allow you to change. You need systems that are not too rigid. And one of the exciting things at USAID is the agency just came out last month with new guidance on our program design, sort of formally from our policy team, that really incorporates adaptive management principles into our program design guidance. And so this is now formal guidance about how USAID programs will be designed. And so that opens the door to allow people to be more adaptive in the work that they're doing. And then the last thing I think that you need is incentives. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, have the data, you can have the systems, but people need to want to do that. And that is in some ways the hardest thing, is that culture change of changing people's mindset and also rewarding people for a different set of behaviors to constantly drive for more cost-effective results and constantly drive to have an order of magnitude leap of improvement over what you're trying to do. I think that's the reason that Silicon Valley has been so successful, and in that case, the reward is financial, but I think in the social good space, the reward is really saving lives around the world.
Mm-hmm. And with the incentive and with a shifting system, is the data available? Is the data out there to acquire, or do you have to actually produce and create the data from scratch in many of these environments?
I think both. I think both more data exists today, certainly, than it did 5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, with the advent of digital technologies, it just most people around the world now have mobile phones, and there's an incredible amount of data being driven, created there. But there's also the opportunity to get more data. You know, we now have low-cost satellites that are allowing you to get data on, you know, satellite geospatial data much more quickly and accurately. You have, you know, you can do mobile surveys with people who are out there on mobile phones, getting them to send you SMSs or call you to give you information. You can deploy sensors. So there's a lot of different ways that we can use the data that exists and also gather additional data that helps inform us of what's working and what's not working.
Are you finding that as well, Jacqueline?
Yeah, and, you know, to Anne May's point, she spoke very eloquently about what's needed to get make government more innovative. On the other hand, you've got the Silicon Valley Innovation Corridor. Mm-hmm. And I think the fair question can be, and what can we do to help focus Silicon Valley more on the issues that really matter and solving the problems that really count? One of the things that we're trying to do as Google.org is think about, how do we encourage companies? How do we encourage the entire sector to think about what is unique to us as a business, and how could we contribute using the best of who we are, using our technology, using our approach with data and evidence, to make the biggest changes? If you look across the philanthropic sector, if you look at private giving, for example, in the U.S., it's like $335 billion. Of that, only 5% comes from companies. But Larry Page, our CEO, likes to say, most people will spend most of their time working for a company. And as Anne May said, millennials, today's workers, want to know that the place where they are working is contributing to solving some of the biggest problems. So I think there's a huge opportunity for corporations to step up and not only to put real resources in, but also to bring along the best of who they are. And that can be helping with data scientists, helping to figure out innovation paths forward against some of our hardest challenges. And this is sort of a newer area that we're seeing, though. More and more companies step up and say, we want to do this because it's the right thing to do. And oh, by the way, it's also really going to help us with recruiting and retention.
And what came first, the companies deciding it was a good thing to do, or the demand from their employee base?
Well, in the case of Google, it was actually our founders, you know, who before the company became public, before the IPO, Larry and Sergey wrote their first letter from the founders, and they said, Google is not a conventional company, and we don't intend to become one. And part of that is that we're going to give 1% of our yearly profit to philanthropy, to Google.org. And that's something that we do, and it's more than $100 million now. So for them, it was part of who they were and how they wanted to establish the identity of their company.
And so we're all somewhat products of the Valley, and Silicon Valley is not known to be short on hubris. And so are we placing too much confidence in technology and Silicon Valley business models to effectively address these big global issues?
I think at times that has been the case. I think we have certainly seen a lot of attempts to, you know, use technology to solve global development challenges. And so we see this proliferation of pilots out there. People are like, hey, I can build an app, you know, for somebody, you know, in Africa, and that will change their lives. It'll help them farm better or do something else better. And very few of these solutions have really scaled, because the reality, as Jacqueline mentioned with the water sensors, is that the world is much more complex out there. I mean, I think that things don't all work the way that they work in Silicon Valley. And so, you know, part of the challenge is marrying both the understanding of the local conditions, the local cultural realities, the fact that people may not even have electricity to charge their mobile phone, let alone have a smartphone, with the incredible brilliance of and talent that we have in Silicon Valley. And that's where, you know, kind of working with local entrepreneurs and talent from Silicon Valley and being able to bring the two together can help us achieve the best of both worlds.
And how do you do that? How do you identify the local talent and bring in their contextual knowledge into helping create more responsive solutions?
I mean, many of the successful social entrepreneurs I see have people from both worlds. Mm-hmm. So one of the success stories, I would say, coming out of the lab is a social enterprise called Off-Grid Electric. They're a company that's based in Tanzania that was started by an American student when she was in Tanzania and recognized that one of the big challenges is that people living in rural areas didn't have electricity. And so In rural areas, if you're living off the grid, the best solution for electricity is solar power. But unfortunately, these families are often very poor. They don't have the upfront capital to be able to purchase a home solar system. And so she came up with a new business model to use mobile money, which is very pervasive in East Africa, to allow people to pay off their home solar system for a few cents a day, often less than they were spending for the cost of kerosene. And so with that, they were able to, over time, over a year or two, be able to own their home solar system and meanwhile get much more clean, reliable energy. And what's exciting about this as a model model is that, you know, one, it's a real business. This is not charity. She's not giving away solar systems to people. They are, you know, people are paying off their solar systems. Off-Grid is making a profit, and that allows them to continue to serve more customers. The other thing that's exciting about it is we at USAID kind of started, funded them in the early days to test out this business model, starting out just with a $100,000 grant. Mm-hmm. And then later, as we sort of saw them prove out their business model, gave them a $1 million grant, and then a third stage grant of $5 million. But off that about $6 million of seed funding from us, they've now been able to raise almost $100 million in debt and equity from private sources. And so it's a real success story in terms of the catalytic role that we can play in government and also an important role that the private sector plays both in enabling them to have a business model that can continue to be financially sustainable beyond our grant, as well as draw in private sector funding to enable them to continue to scale.
It is a fantastic company, and I did visit them in Arusha, and they were kind enough to organize a safari to the Serengeti for my wife and me afterwards. And so they're quite memorable. But Jacqueline, how does Google.org identify local talent around the world to help you address these problems?
Yeah, well, we have a few different mechanisms. I mean, one thing that we do, it's called a Google.org Impact Challenge, is that we'll go into certain markets. Last year, we're in, for example, Brazil. We'll go to India, Korea, Japan, France, and go into each of these countries, each of these regions, and be very open and say, how would you use $500,000 plus technology to make the world better? And so some of our approach is just to be very open, just to open the door as wide as possible and see the best ideas that come in and then provide seed funding. In other approaches and other programs, such as in education, for example, we'll go out proactively and do a landscape analysis and look for best in breed and think about how do we find the best innovators who are working on this particular lever that we think is going to have differential impact. But in terms of making sure that the innovators that we are backing represent the world globally, I think that's where being part of a global company can be really helpful, because a lot of our research is done by our Googlers, by our employees. So having, you know, 60,000 plus teams around the world can help us on our sourcing to find the best talent, the best ideas globally.
Great. So AMA, the World Bank, USAID, others have a stated goal of ending global poverty by 2030. They've picked a date. It's right around the corner, 13 years from now. And so what does that even mean, and is that achievable?
So it's an audacious goal.
Yes.
So extreme poverty around the world is defined as people living under about $1.90 a day. And I think there's still a little less than 1 billion people who are living in extreme poverty. At the same time, over the last 20 years, we've cut the number of people living in extreme poverty in half. So we're making great progress. Okay. But of course, the problems are getting more challenging as you make progress. So today, more and more people who are still living in extreme poverty are in fragile states. So they're living in very unstable environments that make it much harder for us to be able to have the kind of interventions that have worked in the past. So the problems are getting more complex. But I do think it's possible. But I think that it requires us to innovate. And I think that's why we're here to discuss this topic tonight, because the solutions that got us to this point have been effective, but we need new solutions to continue to make the progress that's necessary to really eradicate extreme poverty. And if you imagine, living on $1.90 a day is a really miserable existence. We owe it to people around the world to give them the opportunity to realize their full potential and live meaningful and fulfilled lives, whereas today a lot of them are struggling just to meet their even most basic needs.
Scott, so can I
yeah,
share?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, just I think sometimes those of us in the field can get a little depressed and down and think, gosh, you know, it's not getting better and inequality is getting worse. But there are some really exciting innovations. I think one of the ones I'm really excited about is a group called GiveDirectly that uses mobile technology to do very simply just give money directly to the poor. And when they first came to Google and pitched to us, one of our execs looked at them and said, so you're going to solve poverty by just giving people money. Okay, you must be smoking crack. But, you know, the interesting thing about GiveDirectly, it was started by a bunch of PhD economists, right? So they're meticulous. They have RCTs, which we don't see enough of in our field, to really show that when you give poor money, unencumbered, unconditional, by and large, they make very good choices and are able to deliver outcomes in terms of health and schooling and new businesses that far exceed what I have seen as a development professional, you know, for the past 25 years in the field. So every once in a while, a new approach comes that might buck conventional wisdom a bit. And I think those of us in the field need to push back sometimes that voice that says you must be smoking crack and just say, well, let's look at the data and let's follow the data and let's see how this turns out. We gave them some seed money, one of their first grants, and then the data that they produced was so impressive from that. We actually have been partnering with USAID together building out a system in Rwanda to use GiveDirectly's platform to deliver aid directly to the poor. So I think those of us who are in the sector need to remain optimistic that while these challenges are really hard and eliminating extreme poverty sounds like it can't happen, actually I think with some of these new solutions, new approaches, we can do it.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Anne May Cheng. She's the Chief Innovation Officer and Executive Director at the U.S. Government's Global Development Lab. She's in conversation with Jacqueline Fuller, President of Google.org, and the conversation is moderated by Scott Wu. He's a partner at Omidyar Network. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. World Affairs is a membership organization, and you can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Scott Wu.
So we're a few years into the launch of the lab, and we're 12 years into Google.org. At this point, how do you define success? And can you point to some notable accomplishments or signature accomplishments that you've achieved at this point?
I have a really audacious notion of success. So I really think that we need to go in development from looking at programs that reach tens or hundreds of thousands of people to looking at solutions that can reach tens or hundreds of millions of people, because that's really the scale of the problem that we're trying to tackle. And so, the way you get there is, you don't get there overnight, but it is that you find these solutions that can be sustainable, such as off-grid, that can drive their own growth. And not only have those businesses drive their own growth, now what we're doing, given the success we've seen with off-grid and some other enterprises that are doing similar work in other countries, is really looking at how can we pave the path to allow more massive growth at a system level. So that involves both helping the existing companies scale, but also helping new companies get started in new geographies, as well as looking at how do we generate greater demand. So for example, we have a Grand Challenge Prize out right now to develop low wattage refrigeration systems so that people have a reason to use power to really solve very basic needs. And so it's this kind of systems approach that I think is going to be really important for us to get to that kind of massive scale. The other half, though, is on one hand, we want solutions to reach massive scale. And so we're definitely working on a number of programs to get there. At the same time, it is the systems change of the development sector overall. How can we actually change the development sector to be as nimble and effective and make as rapid progress as Silicon Valley does? And I think if we can retool the development sector, it will be able to generate more and more of these solutions over time.
Jacqueline?
I think from a success standpoint, what Google needs to do and what we hope all of our fellow companies will do is to figure out, hey, with what you're given, with what you have, with who you are, how can you make the biggest impact on the world? So that's what keeps me up at night, is thinking, okay, at .org we have $100 million each year. We have 60,000 Googlers. We have this technology know-how. How can we most bring that together and achieve the greatest impact possible? So I think one of the things that we have learned, and it may be a success, but it's more of a learning, is that we are most successful when we bring all of that together. So I'll give you a quick example. With the refugee situation that hit in the last few years, and looking at having more people, more migrants, more refugees than any other time since World War II, and just this huge mass of humanity moving, we knew as a company we wanted to step up and get involved and to help. And so immediately we start thinking about immediate relief and development. But, you know, we also realized, hey, this is an opportunity for Google to also take a stand and say, you know, as a world, we need to come around together and address this humanitarian issue. And so we tried something new, which we had never done before, which is to put out a global matching campaign where we used our homepage. We used tools, platforms like Gmail and YouTube, and went out to more than a billion users and said, hey, we're donating. Would you like to join us? And we weren't really sure how that was going to go. But within 2 days, we raised more than $11 million. And it's not just the money, though, I think. It's also the fact that people were voting with that and saying, I want to help. I believe this is important. I want to be part of this movement for humanity. Another example with refugees is we donated. We've given, you know, more than $16 million at this point to help causes. But we also bring our engineers who went out on the migration routes, went into the camps to see what were the needs, and did things like made sure Wi-Fi was available on the migration routes and donated Chromebooks, for example, for refugee education, because we know the average time that someone's in a refugee camp now is 17 years. So we need to shift from relief and development to education. We had engineers develop translation cards because we saw in searches the need to go from German to Arabic was 5 times. So creating translation cards and new tools and approaches that will help with immediate translation needs. So I think what we have learned is that we will be most impactful when we bring the best of who we are as Google and all of our assets together against a problem.
And so when you apply that to a problem like the refugee crisis, what would Google define as an objective and key result?
Well, you could look at things like, how many refugees did you reach? So you donated 25,000 Chromebooks, for example, in Germany. And so we'll know exactly how many refugees were able to do things like education courses or language courses or apply for asylum. So we'll look at measures like that. But I think in development, we always want to push towards outcomes, sure. Right? So at the end of the day, providing relief is one thing, but how many people have you helped to actually become educated or actually move forward and get a job or move forward and be able to close asylum or to go to the ultimate endpoint where they desire to be. So measuring those kinds of outcomes is, I think, the real value.
Well, great. Thanks. We've been collecting some of your audience questions, and so I'd like to turn to them and bring them into the conversation. So this first question before me is, how do you prevent techno-imperialism? In other words, forcing the American way of using thinking about technology onto other societies?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that one of the things that's really exciting that we're seeing is that the way that technology is evolving in developing countries is very different than how it's evolved here in the United States. And so there is a real local flavor. You know, one of the things I mentioned earlier is mobile money, which has really taken off. It started out in Kenya. And now today, I think something like 80% of Kenyans actually have a mobile money account. The system there is called M-Pesa. And this is something that we don't have here. Like, everyone transfers money using simple feature phones, and they're able to transfer money to their family if they're living in different areas. They're able to pay for goods. They're
able to pay for services
and pay their bills. Yes. And it's actually been a huge driver of the economy there and a huge driver for entrepreneurship there, because now there's a way to make micropayments in a really cheap and affordable way, and it's given access not only to being able to create businesses, but for individuals when they have a mobile payment account, what it allows them to do is for the first time have a bank account. Most of these people never even had a bank account. Their formal banks are too far from where they live, and so now they can start to save money for the first time, be able to get a loan, maybe be able to get insurance, and start being able to manage their financial lives in a way that empowers them much more. And so I think it is very much, we can't imagine that we can provide the solutions from here in Silicon Valley and know what is right for people, but we really have to be on the ground working with people who understand the local realities, and often we'll find solutions that are very different from the ones that
we're here. So instead of forcing the American way, we're hoping their way comes to affect us at some point in the future. Jacqueline, do you have?
No, I was just going to agree with that. I think that's a perfect example. We need their techno-imperialism to come our direction.
I mean, another way we're seeing this is also not necessarily in the digital space, but with frugal innovation. So we're seeing in developing countries, because they're working under much more financial constraints, people can't afford the expensive products that we have here, that people are inventing much cheaper solutions to some of the things that we have here. So, for example, through one of our Saving Lives at Birth grant challenge, there's been a couple solutions for what's called a bubble CPAP machine, which is a machine that helps infants with obstructed airways to be able to breathe better. And they've come up with solutions that are like 10 times less expensive. India and China are real leaders in this space and coming up with these kinds of frugal innovations that eventually will probably come back to the United States, because we want things that are 10 times cheaper as well. But there hasn't been the forcing function to have that happen yet here.
I hear they have tablet computers for $20. Why can't we get that? Okay, so the next question is, will donors fostering more adaptive cultures in their grantees increase accountability? Are grantees sometimes afraid to share failures publicly?
Yeah, can I speak to that?
Yeah, yes, please.
So one of the things at, .org, we were like, oh, we're all about data and transparency. You know, we're just going to publish our results on the website. And it was interesting when we went then and talked to our partners to realize that the incentive system for them is quite different from the incentive system for us. So in fact, with the water sensor that I mentioned earlier, we went to a lot of different water nonprofits to talk about whether that would be interesting. And a lot of them were very interesting until we got to the very end, where we said, and we require you to publish in real time your data on the web about how many of your water points are actually working or not. And then crickets, but Charity Water was excited about that. But I don't actually blame them, because to be honest, the funding sector, we as funders are so fickle and are so unwilling to have the kinds of nuanced conversations about effectiveness. And we don't understand failure. We don't embrace failure. So I actually don't blame nonprofits. I think it's a problem with the overall funding system, and that the blame lies primarily with the funders.
In the government, if you have a failure, does that risk jeopardizing your funding stream?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think we're accountable to taxpayers and to Congress, and so we do have to be thoughtful about how we take risk. At the same time, we've had lots of support for our innovation programs that do take risk, and the way that it works for us is that we take a smart risk. So we'll make small investments, like that $100,000 we invested in off-grid. We place lots of small bets like that, and when you're investing $100,000, you can take a lot more risk than when you're investing $100 million. So we really try to take those risks with smaller amounts of money, and then tier up our funding as we gain more and more confidence that a solution is going to work.
Great. So next question is, how big of an issue is it to navigate regime and political change and to maintain a constancy in the efforts against poverty? USAID works in all kinds of environments around the world. You see all kinds of political upheavals. How difficult is that to navigate?
Well, I think, there's both political change in our country as well as political change in other countries, and both of them can be challenging. One of the great things about the lab and what we're doing is that we've been able to garner real strong bipartisan support. Just last month, we had a bill passed in the House supporting the Global Development Lab as a lab authorities bill. Because at the end of the day, it's a nonpartisan issue to have more cost-effective development and to use technology and innovation for us to be able to solve the world's problems. And so we've really, the whole time of the lab's existence, have had strong bipartisan support. In developing countries, as I mentioned, more and more of poverty is being concentrated in these fragile states. And it's a huge challenge. It's very hard to be able to put together programs. This is just the program Jacqueline mentioned of, being able to provide clean water when bombs are exploding and, coups are happening and so forth. And so, We certainly work in those environments. A lot of times the interventions are more humanitarian, and we look towards ways that we can work with the local governments to stabilize countries and build institutions so that they can have an environment that will foster long-term growth.
And Jacqueline, does Google tend to gravitate towards or stay away from those kind of situations, those hotspot situations?
Well,
around the
world? Scott, I was actually thinking back to my time with the Gates Foundation and living in India, and we invested huge amounts of money in setting up HIV prevention, for example, surveillance networks and programming and working alongside tuberculosis programs, for example, for treatment. And it would just kill you because you would set up this beautiful system with the local health officials of India, and then they would get a new chief minister, and they would say, I have different priorities, or I don't trust this program, and, you know, want to wipe it away. So I think one of the things I learned there was, one, frankly, just to be more politically aware, to get more politically savvy, to get a little more street smart, and to think about how can we create programs that are wins for the local political leaders. So one of the things that we did is we started publishing these report cards by district that showed things like the HIV prevalence or tuberculosis incidence, and then published these in like newspapers. And then the chief ministers all of a sudden had so much incentive because they wanted their geographies to look good and their regions to look good. So I think part of it is that we also have to become a little savvier about how to work and create incentives that go in the right way for political leaders.
So are you working on any environmentally friendly technologies for the developing world, either of your organizations?
I think there's a number of different things mm-hmm. on the environmental front. It covers a pretty wide gamut. Mm-hmm. A couple things that we're working on is, for example, using satellites to monitor deforestation mm-hmm. in the Amazon, for example. We've mm-hmm. Worked with Peru to use satellite data to be able to monitor damage to the environment from illegal gold mining, and as a result, they were able to then publicize the effects that this was having and raise awareness and raise the public campaign to really put an end to this. Another example, as I mentioned earlier, the DESAL Prize, one of the big challenges is having clean water available because a lot of areas live where there's only brackish water that's not drinkable or usable to use for agriculture. And so with the DESAL Prize, we put out a prize call to come up with mm-hmm. a solution that through renewable energy would be able to produce more drinkable water from brackish water than before. And so the winning contestants, we had three finalists go out to the deserts of New Mexico and actually have a desalination off. And they actually had to set up their systems, you know, out in the desert and leave them for 24 hours and see what they could mm-hmm. produce. And the winner was from MIT, and they were able to, with their system, produce twice as much drinkable water from brackish water using renewable energy as the current solutions that are out there today. And so this is now being piloted out in the Middle East where there's real challenges with access to water.
Okay. Are you aware of any new technologies to help evaluate the impact of development interventions?
Well, we already talked about sensors, which I think is one new direction. I think one thing we as funders can do is it's not necessarily a technology problem, I think. It's almost more of a funding problem in that we need to be willing to fund evaluation and impact studies, and particularly third-party impact evaluations, and then be willing to publish the results of those regardless of the outcomes. And I think if we changed that behavior and changed that funding, that would allow groups to be able to have better evidence about their own effectiveness, and it would help all of us as funders, government, private, to fund the best solutions and not just what I call the cocktail party circuit, mm-hmm. you know, the people who are the best at schmoozing or, you know, talking up their solutions. So I think there is some technology issue there, but I think it's almost more of an issue of human behavior on that one.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think one of the things that I am really interested in exploring is this notion of outcomes-based funding. Mm-hmm. In development, we typically fund projects or programs or activities, and they sometimes lead to great outcomes and they sometimes don't. But what if we instead funded outcomes that we offered people to pay them for every child you educate and actually not just goes to school but actually is able to graduate.
And then be very agnostic mm-hmm. about how they get there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's a great way to unleash innovation if you have the incentive out there to achieve better results and let people take unexpected pathways to get there.
We've been doing that locally here in the Bay Area just around homelessness. So we're trying a variety of approaches to try and help with affordable housing here, mm-hmm. here locally in the Bay Area. And one of them is a pay-for-performance kind of approach to say, sure. you know, let's see how many families that you, homeless families that you can get into temporary shelter and then long-term housing and then pay, as you're saying, and may against the outcomes.
And who's the buyer of that outcome in that case?
In this case, it's a consortium. There's several of us who are buying outcomes, yes. Including government and private funders.
Is USAID also deploying social impact bonds, development impact bonds, and other pay-for-performance?
Oh, we're starting to explore that. Okay. I think it's still an area that's been deployed now in the U.S. and in across Europe. It's still fairly experimental, trying to figure out how exactly to structure these to be the most effective. And we're starting to explore ways to do that in development as well.
Okay. So the next question is that the vast majority of small NGOs barely use current technologies. How do we help them adapt to the new technologies that are being developed and improve their basic operations?
I mean, one of the things, you know, as Google, we talk about all this next generation technology and whatnot. But the other thing that we do is we just make our ads and apps available for nonprofits for free. So one of the best things that we can do is just help people have free access to things like Gmail. So if you're working for an NGO and you haven't checked it out, check out Google for Nonprofits, because that's a scalable way. And you know, for us, it's several billion dollars worth of free basic core technologies to help nonprofits just do their daily business in a more efficient way.
Okay. So we have a follow-up question for Jacqueline. You said that organizations like Google.org need to become more politically savvy. How do you do that, especially when this is not a core strength of Silicon Valley companies?
Yeah. Amen to that, right? Well, just so using the example that I mentioned earlier with GiveDirectly, right? So we think this is, wow, this is a great evidence-based approach. They've got randomized controlled trials. They're delivering 90 cents of every dollar given ends up in the hands of the poor with phenomenal outcomes. This is great. We'll just fund it and then it'll just get taken up, right? Because it's so clear. And then you see that doesn't happen. So one of the things that we've learned to do is a little bit more advocacy. So, for example, working alongside, having conversations with USAID and saying, showing our data, and I, you know, met with Rashad, the administrator, and just talk through, hey, maybe we could do a joint pilot together, and then this could potentially, for example, become a nice barometer to measure all your programs against, right? And just measure them against cash, because certainly there'll be development programs that will maybe even exceed the outcomes of pure cash. But, like, let's just have a barometer there. So, you know, I joined high-level panels with DFID. I meet with ministers and cabinet officers to share the data. So I think we're learning as Google that it's not enough to just sort of, you know, fund something and walk away. If you really think that it's promising and has great potential, you need to be willing to step in and do some of that advocacy as well.
So is that an acknowledgement that you're that you need government, that you're embracing the government?
100%.
Because typically the Valley wants to stay away. And
I mean, that's such such a misinformed notion if people think that Silicon Valley is going to solve anything. I mean, as I was saying to Anne May, you know, government can do what we do, but add a few zeros to it, right? If you really want to bring scalable change, you know, you need to partner with the government. And so I think our job as philanthropy is to be risk capital, to be catalytic, to bring our certain strengths with Roche's technology and data and evidence, and then take the best of that and then work with scalable partners who are able to bring it to, as Anne May was saying, the hundreds of millions. We need to be talking about hundreds of millions, not just cute little pilots with a couple dozen.
So you've both spent time in government, at foundations, at huge tech companies. What is the most important lesson that you've learned in doing this work that you've been doing that you'd like to share with this next generation?
I would say, you know, it's really easy to get caught up in things like what's the exact right technology, or what is my ROI on this, or, you know, am I going to get that post in the government or is this, you know. But at the end of the day, what all of us, you know, all of us in this room, all of us who really care about development, I think is the most important thing, is just to keep that core empathy, and that core compassion, and remembering every day why we are doing what we do, and to make every decision with that in mind. So, like, in my office at Google, on my desk, I have this photo from when I was in India of these three beautiful little kids who are playing in one of the just most hellacious environments I've ever seen, you know, barefoot, wet. They were beggars who were making their money by recycling things off of the street, and they have the most beautiful smiles on their face. So I think the most important thing is at the end of the day to always ask yourself, is what I do and these decisions I'm making going to help those girls? Is it going to help people like them? Am I going to come alongside of them and help them in dignity and allow them to take up the cause and allow them to improve their future?
Yeah, that's really powerful. And I would add to that, I think humility is really important. Mm. I think we need to recognize there's so much we don't know, and there's so much that we have yet to learn and tap into. And so in solving challenges like that, and I think one of the things I've come to appreciate in working across different sectors is, you know, both how much we have to bring, but how much others have to bring, and how important it is for us to really partner with others to come up with solutions that can really be the most effective as possible.
And am I actually going to ask a follow-up to that? So for this new generation rising that's so interested in these global problems, and what advice would you give them? How can they channel that energy and those ambitions? And what available organizations or institutions? I mean, a lot of these things that we're talking about may not have existed or been available to us 20 or 30 years ago. Or, I mean, in my case, not maybe 5 or 10 for you. But in any event, what advice would you give this next generation?
I think when it comes to global development, I think there's no substitution for actually spending time in
Amen.
Developing countries
yep.
and understanding what the challenges are. And I think that has ignited the passion and inspiration of so many people, just having that personal experience and, you know, having a personal connection to a place or a person or a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then finding ways, and I think it's different for all of us, finding ways that you can personally engage to be able to bring your talents and your resources towards actually addressing those problems.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the way I hire at Google.org is I always ask people, tell me about your firsthand experience with poverty. Tell me about your firsthand experience with a development challenge. And I really, really like to hire people who have lived and worked in developing countries, or if they're working on domestic issues, okay, how much time have you really spent working and listening and being within the environment that you care so much about? So 100% echo Anne May on that. Number one is just getting that experience. I think the other thing is, you know, I get asked by young people often, you know, right out of college, like, what should I do, yeah. Scott, if I want to, yeah. you know, change the world? You know, when I was coming out of college, if you wanted to change the world, you know, you joined the government. So that's what I did. I joined HHS right out of college, you know, because, or maybe a nonprofit. I think we have a lot more fluidity these days in terms of social enterprises. I mean, one of the things I love about Amidyar and the work that Scott is doing is that they are agnostic about whether they're investing in a for-profit, a not-for-profit, just very fluid and very open to what is the best solution. So I think for young people today, getting less caught up in exactly what the entity is, but finding the smartest team and the best people or the best product or the idea that you think is going to change the world and go there.
Well, with that, I think we're out of time. So thank you very
Thanks,
much. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Anne May Chang, Jacqueline Fuller.
And Scott. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Anne May Chang, Executive Director at the U.S. Government's Global Development Lab. She was in conversation with Jacqueline Fuller, president of Google.org, and the conversation was moderated by Scott Wu. Scott is a partner and head of investments at Omidyar Network. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.